Today's program was brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit ConsiderBardwellFarm.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today, patriotically drinking cans of Budweiser, clad with the flag, celebrating Mr. Tom Mylan and his Meat Hook cookbook, the meat book, as it were. And subsequently, I wore all red today, and I realized, walking out of the house, you know, holding this in my hands, I kind of dressed like meat for you.
Thank you.
Not well marveled, but meat nonetheless. No.
Yeah, a lean cut.
Yeah. That's what they call me. That was my nickname during this book, the lean cut.
Yeah.
So
that's your DJ name.
So here's the disclaimer. I got to joyously work on this book with you, and we also have the wonderful Michael Fusco Straub, designer of this book, art director of this book, who's priorly been on the food scene here too. So we're going to kind of wrap a little bit about this book specifically, because if you want to hear more about Tom, the lovely Diane Stemple already had you on Cutting the Curd. And
that's true.
We've covered your past, and no one really wants to know that.
No one cares.
Even though Reno, Nevada is still like a crazy enigma to me.
As it is to me.
Best response I could ask for.
Well, it's the biggest little city.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's contradictions.
The Meat Hook Meat Book. You know, I keep on using buy, butcher, and cook your way to better meat, which is verbatim the subtitle of this book, because that's exactly what it is. It's not just instructional. It's not, you know, you postulizing, but it's proof that better meat does come from knowing all these things. When did you actually begin to know these things? Believe in yourself.
I mean, really, this book is in no small way the result of going through this, you know, sort of radical changeover of the restaurants Diner and Marlowe and Sons from being two restaurants that bought meat like a traditional restaurant, just pieces and that sort of thing, to going to a restaurant or to switching over to a restaurant where we brought in whole animals and had to like figure out how to use every single part. And it was a lot of trial and error. And at the end of it, you know, we all sort of came away with an intimate knowledge, like a practical knowledge, not like stuff we read in books, but like a you know, boots on the ground, you know, trial and error, this works, this doesn't work, knowledge of, you know, what you do with every single part.
Well, I mean, aside from having that insight, spatial concerns, perishability, because I know you were doing this all out of an Airstream behind the restaurants.
Well, it was the shack next to the Airstream. Yeah, the Airstream was much nicer.
Yeah. But, I mean, you have those concerns opening up, you know, the Meat Hook, too, opening up a butcher shop. You have to make ends meet by using all those parts. When you first opened the Meat Hook, what were the parts you were most kind of wary of?
Pig heads.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ask any person that does whole animal butchery. Pig heads. Real problem.
What is the problem?
Well, they're giant. You know, they weigh 20 pounds. And they're mostly bone and not that much meat. And nobody wants to buy them. And to make them into something that somebody wants to buy, you have to brine them and then braise them and then pick the meat and then do something else with it. Like, you know, we do scrapple. I mean, we have like at the shop, like probably like 7, 8, 9 different recipes of things to do with pig heads. But it's a long process, a lot of labor, not a ton of yield, but you have to use those parts up.
See, I love how you say at the shop, because I think it was in the intro you talk about what a butcher shop really is. It's kind of an institution. you know, a place that somebody comes and doesn't just buy something, but interacts with the purchaser or the, you know, the processor and
right.
learns how to interpret that piece.
Yeah.
So when you say you had these recipes, you told your, you know, patrons how to cook a pig's head for from day one.
No one has ever wanted to buy.
Really?
No. What I mean, like things like people don't want to buy, they literally don't buy them.
So what are you surprised about that people actually buy there?
Well, I mean, now that there's like the whole, like, you know, there's like all these different bone broth fad diets, we sell a lot of beef bones, a lot of, just a lot of bones in general, which I think, you know, if it was 7-8 years ago before the whole paleo thing and then all these different, like, you know, sort of like trend diets and stuff that are all about like bone broth and 100% grass fed beef and minerals and all this kind of stuff, you know, we would just be, you know, there's only so much beef broth you can make and actually sell, or pho broth or any other thing that you can turn those bones into. And there's only so many people that have, you know, 100-pound Rottweilers that can eat a beef knuckle bone. So
yeah.
We literally would have been throwing those away, because there's some things that you just can't. You can't salvage every single part, or at least we can't with the businesses that we have right now. I mean, the goal is to have a business where every single thing can go to. So maybe, I mean, so like maybe we'll open a noodle shop instead of a sandwich shop next year to like make use of all the bones or something.
I mean, well, first let's say congrats about the sandwich shop.
Oh, thank you. I had almost nothing to do with that. I mean, I did a lot of demolition there.
Yeah.
But that was all Brent and Gil and JoJo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is another outpost for you to use a lot of the techniques and skills from this book.
Yeah. Exactly.
So let's talk about the book specifically, and Mike, you can chime in as much as you want, because you didn't want this to be another, you know, butchering book. You didn't want this to be another, you know, how to cook a steak book. What made this different in your mind, both, you know, prose and visually?
I mean, as far as the conception goes, I didn't want to do another, you know, like, grilling book. Not that there's anything wrong with that. There's just a lot of them, and I didn't want it to be another, like, this is how you butcher something, like, you know, a bunch of, you know, hands holding a knife with a pink blob of meat on a piece of wood, because that book was already out there. I mean, this is kind of like late to the game as far as butchering books. You know, like 10 years ago when, you know, I started heading in this direction, there was literally nothing to read, and now there's a lot. And, you know, the way that I conceived it is like, okay, let's try to somehow trick people into learning all the things that, like, that I learned trying to come up with things to do with every single part of the animal. And what that really is it's tricking people into, like, thinking like a butcher, you know, having this, you know, very, having like a basic working understanding of, like, how every part of every animal is, you know, how to treat it, how to cook it, like what it's good for, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, that all starts from where all the parts actually come from. And
on the animal.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about pigs in space for a second. Because these crazy 3D telegraphing maps of primal cuts to, you know, lesser known cuts like the Secreto and such. Who was the blame? I mean, who was the thank for something as wonderful as that?
What, the pigs in space
part? Yeah.
I mean, it was, initially it was an idea that I came up with because I, you know, had just gotten the Modernist Cuisine book or books, you know, the whole like hobby kit. And I was looking at that photography and I was really inspired. You know, I didn't want to like rip them off, but I was like, okay, like let's think really visually about this and also not like show how the animals like come apart and go back together. The inspiration really came from that, from Modernist Cuisine cookbook, and then I used to like hang out with a lot of hot rodders in Southern California, and I had air cooled Volkswagens, and you know, I had a lot of old car repair manuals, and one of the things that all those manuals had generally was like a big exploded, you know, engine, so every little piece is coming out, so you can see how it comes apart and how it goes back together, you know, all the pistons and the piston rings and, you know, every little tiny piece. And I thought that was a really visually succinct but also really trippy way of doing that. And I was like, yeah, like let's, you know, that's let's figure out how to do that. And then Judy said, let's put it in space.
Thank you, Judy, for letting us go to space for this book.
You're welcome.
What a wonderful budget Artisan had, sending us three astronauts, whatever it is.
Yeah, and it was hard to sort of figure out how to make that work. And I think we definitely had some conversations about it. Like, there was like a moment when we were going to like literally hang all the meat apart.
Oh my God.
You remember
wow.
that? Like, we talked about that.
Yeah, we were going to hang it off scaffoldings.
Yeah, we were going to hang it off scaffoldings. And we were like, oh yeah, like, and then we'll just take the picture against black and then we'll just put the space in. And like, like, I don't know why there was a moment where we thought that was going to work.
That would
and
be
I'm
an
really
amazing
glad.
Installation in front of the meat hook. If you ever want to redo that.
It would be disgusting.
It would be amazing for like 40 minutes until everything got like sweaty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we quickly sort of figured out that there would be the only way I was going to be able to do it would be to like shoot each piece and sort of manipulate it and get it all so it looked like it was in relation to each other, like in Photoshop basically, and that's what we did.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel like we were totally terrified of the whole.
Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't do that until the end. I mean, we didn't figure
out. Oh yeah, we
kept
on pushing it back.
Yeah, like that was the last thing we did.
Well, but I mean, like, I remember when we met at Tuffet with MHC, and we were just like, so this is the thing we want to do. How do we do that? He's like, oh, no big deal. We'll just put it against gray. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
And we were like, you're hired.
Yeah, we were like, thank God, somebody knows what to do.
But it still wasn't easy.
It wasn't easy. But at least like you were like, you had a vision for how it was going to be.
Yeah.
We were like, I mean, you know, like, I feel like we're both just like, yeah, in space. And then we're actually like, oh shit, how do we do that? You know, like.
But then, I mean, seeing the final product, it makes sense. And actually seeing the process throughout, I thought I knew animals. I thought I knew butchering a little bit, but seeing something taken apart and then put back together actually really formalized, you know, an arm chuck to me. Like, it was always this kind of ephemeral thing.
Right.
But I almost feel like you should have a class where you walk people through the step of disassembling and reassembling, you know, certain primal cuts.
Well, I mean, that's weirdly enough, that's actually how I learned to butcher. So this really amazing, crazy person named Aaron Lenz, who does consulting, if anybody wants to look him up, Aaron J. Lenz, plugging him. But at the time, he was the general manager at Fleischer's, and he was kind of in charge of teaching me how to butcher. And so he'd have me take apart an arm chuck or like a beef leg or something like that, and, you know, which was difficult enough. And then he'd be like, now put it back together. You know, he was like an amazing dick about it, you know, and he'd be like, no, no. And he wouldn't tell me what was wrong, so I just have to do it over and over again, you know, like literally like process of elimination, and like on this, you know, the seventh iteration he'd be like, yeah, mostly that's pretty good. Yeah.
So arm chuck, how many parts usually?
Well, I mean, if you are looking in like the NAMP book, I mean, I think it's like cut up into like six pieces or something, but I mean, the way that we take it apart in the book, and at the shop, I mean, the book is just basically like kind of a, like the shop jammed into a, like, you know, a lot of lube and just right into it. You know, the way that we take it apart at the shop, I mean, depending on how crazy we're getting, it's, you know, it's like 20 pieces, you know.
Because, I mean, we talk about the hidden stakes.
Right.
And I think there were four of them. I always remember the rope.
Right. Yeah.
Let me think of the other one. There's so much meat in this book. It's like, thankfully I have the book in my hand.
Yeah.
As a reference guide, because I don't know how you keep this all in your head at the same time, too.
Well, I mean, it's just, you just do it over and over again. I mean, that's just like, you know, like at this point, I mean, thousands of arm chucks. I don't even know how many I've taken apart. Or
chuck tender, flat iron.
Flat iron, Paleron. Yeah, the list goes.
But these are things that people usually just grind into burger meat.
Yeah.
But what you're also doing in the Meat Hook Meat Book is kind of separating those, you know, almost telegraphing those out further past the animal and saying, this can be its own thing as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we took it apart, like, took everything apart as far as you possibly could and, like, have it still look like something that could go back together. I mean, it's like, we don't take everything apart as far as it could go, because then it would just be like, it would be like very abstract. It would be like Dolly-esque, I think, you know, if we had gone like all the way.
And I'd probably be like dead right now.
Yeah. you'd be like blind and bald.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, then the most rewarding shoots must have been things like the man steak.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was also the best text message I've ever gotten in my life, because I was going to... Or I think I got one for my bachelor party.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I want to explain this to my friends, like, what it is. I know how to cook it because we cooked it on, you know, your rooftop.
Sure.
And then I asked Mike, I'm like, hey, can you ask Tom what a pin bone steak is? And you sent him, or I think you had the text, this
I just copied it out of the book.
It was one of the... I mean, explain to me again what a pin bone steak is. Because, well, we had like an 11-pounder on the roof.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it is like literally the old 96er. You know, basically where the loin, the drop loin, which is like basically the part of the rear quarter of the cow, and where that transitions from the loin into the back leg of the animal, it sort of like forms this large bell shape. And usually those are all separated out into, you know, tri-tip and top sirloin and, you know, tenderloin and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, when we first started the meat hook, it was just the three of us, you know, myself and Brent and Ben, my partners. And so we were like, no, we're not going to take those things apart. We're just going to like dry age them whole and then just cut these giant steaks off of it and just throw them in the case. We just, you know, because we were having to do these sort of time-saving measures, because we were like, we didn't even have a porter. We still like mopped our own floors and washed our own dishes. So it's kind of like, not the necessarily the birth of, but that's kind of like the reason why the man steak sort of became so emblematic of the shop and is so emblematic of the book.
Well, it's also like a phoenixology. This is something that used to exist, and it was like a butcher's treat to almost other butchers. You know, it was like an in-the-know kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you see pictures of it in, like, you know, just sort of like regular meat cooking books from like the 40s and 50s and into the early 60s. And then as soon as box meat sort of starts up in the 60s and 70s, it completely just evaporates, you know, from our sort of, you know, collective cultural cooking knowledge. It's very much like a steak of the 50s.
I mean, as does beef offal, which is, I think, one of everybody's favorite spreads.
Yeah.
Because the size of a beef heart or a beef liver is...
Yeah, the beef liver is really... I mean, that's like 20 pounds.
Yeah.
That's a really big liver.
I almost wish we had scale on that page, because, I mean, it's pretty, like visually striking. But at the same time, I don't think people...
We should have put a quarter down or something.
I don't know, but, you know, we got our hands dirty. It's not like, you know, we had prop stylists sitting there. No, we were sitting there moving meat around. There's a part in your book where you said, if you're going to start butchering, you know, maybe crappy jeans and a t-shirt are a good idea. I didn't think about that coming to the photo shoots.
Yeah, no.
And then there were a couple pairs of jeans that didn't make it through that summer.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, wear clothes you do not care about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But beef liver. I remember, Mike, you were the one kind of handling a lot of that offal.
Yeah, like by the time we got to that point, you know, that was when we were, like, Tom would, like, cut it. Or, like, Tom would bring it out, and then I would bring it to you, and then you would shoot it. And so it was really, like, we were, like, we were just passing things off to each other, basically, at that point. Because
yeah, like a fire brigade of, like raw meat.
Because, like, you would cut, like, you cut that whole arm chuck down, and you were putting it in order.
Yeah.
And so you were shooting it in order, so I knew what the order was, basically.
Yeah.
And when I got all the pictures from you. And so it was, and you were so busy cutting, so I kind of was there. It was just, that was, like, a little insane.
This was done in real time.
I mean, we did those in, like, didn't we do like the whole cow in one day and then the whole pig in one day and then the whole lamb? I mean, it was just like day after day after day.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those days we did like multiple.
Yeah.
I mean, the smaller they got, the easier it got, sort of.
But like the grosser it got.
Also.
Yeah.
I feel like there should be accreditation on certain pages of how much work goes into that page.
Yeah.
Like maybe it should be a thicker page or some texture denoting.
Yeah.
How much was done.
Like on the commentary, how many times did we shoot the mutton chop? Like things like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you know, now we have, like, the book is actually a real thing and it's, like, in the shop. And I see, you know, and there's, like, oh, congrats on the book. And they're, like, flipping through and they just, like, flip right past, like, all these things in space. They're like, oh, this is cool. And then flip. I'm just like, don't you understand how much time that took? Like, look at it. Like, look at it.
It probably would have been easier for us to go to space and dismember, you know, take apart these animals. than what we actually did.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, we shot everything, and then I it took me, I mean, and then I had a baby, and then my wife had a baby, and then I was home siloing and assembling all of those things for like the first 2 months of my kid's life. And I would just go downstairs whenever he was sleeping and do it for like an hour, and then I'd be back upstairs like on dad duty. It was like insane. It was really
great. Yeah, I'm sure at some point you were just like, oh, I wish there were less pieces.
Yeah. Well, it's like I didn't look to see how far it would be until I was over. So like I was just doing it in order, but I wasn't seeing how much more I had to go.
Right.
And I just kept going, and it was like, you know, days in, and I'm just like, holy
shit.
When
does this stop?
Yeah. And like my eyes would be like all bloodshot. I'd like come up because I'd be like looking at these little tiny things, zooming in on them, and
yeah,
trying to silo around like all these little tiny things.
Yeah.
It was tough.
I imagine it's like one of those things where they just like, you just like, it infects your dreams or something.
Yeah.
It's like,
I definitely was up. I mean, I was definitely up a lot thinking about this book.
You and me both need book Inception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just have to say that editing the words is not that different.
There's no, we're not discrediting that at all. I mean, this, I mean, it is a tome at this point. I mean, it's how many thousands of words went into it?
I think the last, when I sent in the last, like, real big edit, it was like up to almost 80,000 words.
Yeah.
And I was really proud of myself when like the first draft was like, you know, 50 or something thousand words. I was like, wow, I didn't know I had these many words in me. And then it's like 80,000 words, like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I said more detail.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm gonna go back and count how many words we say on this show and just see what like half an hour or so seems like, because again, going to the butcher shop and talking to you, you know, first whatever minutes are bullshit, like, how you doing, what's up, and then you kind of get to the meat of it, the meat,
right?
And the fact that you've put it in here concisely, concisely as you can.
Well, but it's kind of a natural process. Like, I mean, in a like real practical way, a lot of the writing in the book is basically just sort of an elongated, more elaborate version of things that I say to our customers like every single day across the counter. And like the meat hook gets 20% busier every year, and so I have to like get
20%
more concise. So yeah, these aren't even like, this isn't like the verbose version, this is like, yeah, the real high and tight version.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna take a quick break and come back and find out how long you can hold raw meat in your mouth. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're going to, you know, get right to the raw meat.
In your mouth.
In your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The cannibal sandwich. I mean, this is Brent's dad.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's really kind of the most amazing dad food recipe in the world. It's just like raw hamburger on a hamburger bun with like, I mean, well, the recipe that ended up making it in the book is a little bit more elaborate. It's more like steak tartare.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got more things going on than just salt and pepper. But the actual, like, original recipe for this is, it's just like grocery store hamburger, salt and pepper, put it in a bun, force your children to eat it.
I mean, okay, give some context of, you know, where Brent came from.
I mean, yeah. So my partner Brent, like, grew up, you know, just outside of Pittsburgh, in, you know, his really lovely mother, Jane, was a school teacher, and his really deeply insane, really charming father, Bud, was a flooring guy. And, you know, like, just, I mean, I don't know. I feel like... Once you reach a certain point of living in New York, you really start to, like, appreciate people who are, like, a stone dick. And that's, like, that's Bud Young, you know, stone dick.
Yeah. And you can experience that stone dick with the long dong buds, but yeah. we'll talk about
that
later.
That's a completely
but
different.
Back to the cannibal sandwich. I mean, this was, how does Zappa say it? Mother of invention, you know. Raw meat, because that's what they had. Hamburger gun, because that was easy. And
yeah.
They ate it. They enjoyed it. I'm air quoting. Enjoyed it.
I think they just ate it. I think like there was no real option there.
But what made you want to put a recipe like that in this book? Is it the meat or is it the story?
Well, I mean, obviously it's the story. I mean, there's actually a story that goes beyond the story that explains why... it became an important thing to me, and this is basically that when we first opened, when Brent and I first opened Marlowe and Daughters, which is the, you know, Andrew Tarlow and Company's first butcher, or their butcher shop, where we worked briefly before we discovered that this is way too hard of work to do it for somebody else. That there was no cooking appurtenances over there, save for a George Foreman grill. And we would just get, like, starving hungry. We were there, like, 12, 14 hours a day. Because to run a butcher shop with two butchers is, like, really intense, and especially a whole animal butcher shop. And so we would just get so hungry that we would make tartare. And then Brent started telling me this story about the cannibal sandwich. And then so we'd go over to diner and get, like, hamburger buns and, like, onions and stuff and just make these, like, raw hamburgers. And they were fucking delicious. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it seems really weird. My wife's mother, was just like really deeply freaked out by the idea of the cannibal sandwich, even though I'm pretty sure that she's had carpaccio and tartare before. But
yeah, it's not otherworldly.
No, I think it's kind of like that. It's like in a hamburger bun. That's like really fucking you up.
Yeah. Well, out of the two of you, Tom and Mike.
Yeah.
Who was able to hold that raw meat sandwich in their mouth for longer? Because we did a couple different shoots.
I don't remember any of that. I mean, I blacked it out.
That was the first thing we shot, and I think it was really a good thing to shoot first because it, like, really broke the ice, because it got really gross after a while because we were just holding it in our mouth.
Well, it's also just really strange to hold a piece of food in your mouth and not eat it.
Yeah.
For, like, 15 minutes.
Yeah, in, like, the sun of June, whenever it was last,
like,
year.
Yeah, it's, like, hot out.
We were, like, standing outside and with this raw meat in our mouths.
And just getting warmer and warmer.
I mean,
warmer.
I think Tom had it in his mouth longer, for sure.
I don't know.
And
I
that's the shot that made the book. Because,
yeah, I don't remember any
of that. There was one shot of me that... was really good, where I looked like I was, like, in pain.
Yeah.
My eyes were, like, closed.
I'm really surprised that the picture of me made the book. I thought, like, you with that look of, like, strain.
Yeah.
And just like, ugh.
Come on.
It either looked like you were having, like this exquisite, like sort of, like, foodgasm, or you were just like, fuck, I can't, like, hold this in my mouth 1 second longer.
See, where I screwed up, sometimes I do these things called 10-second portraits, where I'm taking a photo of a person, or they think I am, and I have it on video. And why I didn't do it with that, I don't think I actually really fully concepted it until right after that shoot.
Yeah.
But that would have been an amazing trailer for the book.
Just
seeing the wincing. But, I mean, I call them trials and tribulations of this book. They weren't. Again, I'll slightly jokingly, more so lovingly, say it was one of the best summers of my life working on this with you guys because it was fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But a top of it being fun, putting the book together, it's fun because the content was fun.
Right.
I mean, what recipes excite you the most still? Because sometimes, you know, you write a book or you do something over and over, you're like, I mean, chicken nuggets, as crazy as they are, I could have once a week.
Yeah, no. That's like choosing your favorite child. I mean, I think my favorite is probably the fat kid blend. It's not really a recipe, but it's just like of the things that are in there. I really like, I still have a deep abiding love of grinding, you know, raw beef and bacon together and then making it into a hamburger. It's a real winner. Also the pastrami. The pastrami is a really, yeah. It's always really good.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that many people will actually go through the 3-week process of making it as outlined in the book, but you could. And if you do, it's going to be really worth it.
Well, it's kind of like the ham, too. You know, the thing about good meat and good cooking is sometimes it isn't quick.
Right. Yeah.
And you want to know intrinsically how to, you know, make a ham.
Yeah.
Because what we see in the supermarket are those, like, mushy sacks and cryovacs.
Right. Or, like, jammed into a can.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
I mean, that isn't real meat.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, there are a lot of, like, fairly quick and easy recipes in there, just in case anybody would be scared off and just be like, oh, my God, everything in the thing, like, takes, like, 3 weeks to, like, 18 months with the country ham. But, no, there's some quick things.
No, and then you can look at a recipe like the, you know, Hufan, what do you call it? Leg on trotter.
Oh my God, the porchetta.
Yeah. The porchetta with the trotter on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually not a long recipe. That's a pretty quick recipe for what it is.
Right. No, you just have to cook it for a long time.
Yeah. And have an oven big enough.
Yeah, that was a problem. Not big enough for the oven, yeah. Even at the meat hook.
Yeah.
So a lot of people know what a porchetta is, but why the trotter on?
That's actually, again, goes back to like, our Brent in my early days of like trying to figure out how to run a butcher shop at Marlowe and Daughters. And, you know, a big problem was that the, you know, everything that like most people would like want to buy at a butcher shop all went to the restaurants, like all the steaks and everything. So we would have to still fill the cases with things that people didn't really, well, that the restaurant didn't want. And you know, by and large, most of the retail public didn't want. And so at a certain point, it just got to be so ridiculous that we just turned it into a, like an art installation joke. And so Brent, like in a particular moment of delirium, decided to debone an entire pork shoulder but leave the trotter on and make it into a porchetta and just throw it in the case. Because it was expedient. It took up a lot of real estate, and it looked really bizarre. And people would come in and just stare at it and then run away.
I mean, there are these flipped conceptions, too, on a couple other recipes. One of my favorites being the chicken, inside-out chicken pot pie.
Yeah.
I mean, you think you're getting the chicken, and then you're not just getting the chicken.
Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of these things are kind of, you know, because, you know, working at a butcher shop is really hard work, and you get really delirious, especially around the holidays and, like, you know, early summer, and it just leads to, but, you know, but the only way that you have to really express yourself besides drinking a lot of alcohol is to do really weird stuff. And it just sort of like comes to you like Tesla's designs came to him, except far less important.
I want to go back
out of the ether, out of the ether, just goofy ideas.
Well, I want to go back to designs because, Mike, you are inherently part of the meat hook, you know. Constantly
the fifth,
helping
the fifth Beatle.
Yeah. Who's that? Peter York? What was his name?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
No, there was a fifth Beatle.
Oh no, totally.
Yeah,
no, it's a real thing, I think.
But you know, trying to convey a visual message. How is this different than other meat books? How is this different than just branding the shop?
Well, I mean, basically, I think I was brought on to keep the book, like, for lack of a better term, like on brand or whatever, because I originally designed the logo for the meat hook. I've designed everything that they've needed to be designed for the last almost 5 years.
Yeah, it'll be Holy 5 cow. Years in November.
And so when this came about, like, I think I was brought on so we can just keep it looking like the meat hook and just like extend what I've been doing into a book form, which I felt very lucky and fortunate to be able to give, had the opportunity to do by Judy and the people at Artisan. And it was great. I mean, I loved the idea of being, taking all these cool things that I've done for the Meat Hook over the years and things that I've been like super proud of and then putting them into this book and extending that. I mean, like, because obviously this book is a lot more complicated than anything I've ever had to do for them. And so I learned a lot about like how to make the Meat Hook look even better, like, and more sort of evolved. And so, like,
it's like you gave the Meat Hook logo acid.
Exactly.
It just, like, went nuts.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and, like we introduced, like, all these different colors for the chapters and, like, all these little technical things that I'm sort of doing at the shop, too, now. And so that was a really great opportunity to be able to do that. But that's sort of how it came about. Like, that's how I ended up designing it and kind of extending the, you know, the Meat Hook stuff that I'd been doing over the years.
You know, it's going to be interesting because it's funny to hear that this book is informing your design back into the shop.
Oh, absolutely.
To hear how the shop may change because of this book.
Oh, yeah. No, it's like you know, I feel like almost anything in my life is just like a snake eating its own tail on drugs.
Well, like we did those signs that are up sort of are basically sort of designed
around
the way I ended up at things that I added to the book, like new things and like with fonts and colors and stuff. These new signs that are up at the shop are sort of based on stuff that came from the book.
Yeah, and I mean, I just want to say this, like, you know, deciding to go with Artisan, like, a big deal was actually that they were, like, you know, like, foolish enough to allow us to, like, design our own book with our designer.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, but I got my start at Workman, which is part of Artisan, or which Artisan is part of, and so they sort of knew me a little bit, but they knew me as like a kid who was wearing like slacks.
Mikey.
Yeah, like I was wearing like slacks that my mom bought me, you know, and like I was so like I was like a 20, I think I was 24 when I started there, so I'm a lot different now than I was then, and I'm really happy that they like I was good enough to do it.
Do you really feel like you're a lot different? Because I remember working on this book, all we did was talk about music and
yeah,
our
I mean,
glory
I listened to
days.
The same like 90s yeah. like whatever. But yeah, I mean I hope I'm a better designer than I was then. Like that is a real, I really hope I was. And I kind of found my way after leaving Workman, and Workman taught me a lot about how to actually like get shit done, which people who work at Workman know, like, they like the speed and the like the way they do things there is super fast and super intense in certain ways, and like,
yeah, you're not like a pot smoking like freelance web designer
exactly,
in a basement somewhere yeah. just being like, oh no, I'll get that done when I get it done,
yeah,
charging
no.
you hourly.
It
you
was know? Like I was like busting my ass. I really learned how to work there. Like I learned how to really, really work. So it was cool to come back and work on this book, which I think is like the best thing I've ever done.
Talk about more snakes eating their own tails.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Mobius strip yeah. of like this thing. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Well, I felt that way kind of getting roped into this project too, because I met you 10 years ago, if not more.
At that long?
Yeah, in Marlow.
I thought it was 8. Whoa.
Maybe.
Jesus.
Yeah, no, I think it was 10. I moved back in 2004.
Wow.
So it's about 10 years
that
ago.
That is a long. Wow.
And you were there, and I would just hang out because you were the buyer, cheese guy.
Yeah.
But you were making, like, bitters and hot sauce and other things.
Oh, yeah, it was a very, like, wee tinker, like, era at Marlow and Diner. Yeah, bitters, hot sauce. Me and their beverage manager Rachel were like designing really like wacky cocktail menus, like, you know, ramp infused vodka with like walnut oil on top, and I mean just going. And then I mean we were also like doing, you know, the Diner Journal was just getting up and running. Me and Anna were editing that. It was a real like petri dish laboratory of like anarchy there.
I mean, but you bring that same inventiveness to what you do at the Meat Hook.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I have, you know, not just, like, a liberal arts degree. Like, I have, like, a degree that was basically in, like, performance art and, like giant abstract finished fetish paintings, you know. So I just can't help that. Like, I just get bored of, you know, I'd be really bored to, like, you know, just do the same thing over and over. I, like, sometimes, you know, changing everything all the time is not the best thing. it's not really, like, expedient, but I don't know. I feel, like, psychically necessary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are these extensions, and I kind of wanted to end, because it is summertime out today.
Yeah.
With, you know, barbecuing and rippers.
Yeah.
You know, because those are two amazing things that you've done where it's uses a lot of the meat hook, you know, meat, but it also uses a lot of the, you know, ideology and ethos behind what you do as a business and how you bring a community together.
Yeah.
Talk to me about what Rippers kind of means to you.
Fun. Yeah, I mean, it's just fun. I mean, like, that's kind of like what this book is, what Rippers is, what the sandwich shop is. It's just like taking something that's like, you know, fairly normal Americana stuff, you know, like, you know, like a butcher shop. Like, I mean, like who would think that like a butcher shop would be fun, you know, or like a book about meat, who knew, you know, like who would be like, you know, oh, that's like, that's really fun. You know what I mean? But that's kind of what we do, is just like, you know, try to make everything fun in like the most like psychedelic way that we could possibly can. And that's, you know, I think if there's like, beyond the sort of like more verbose, like, oh, but well-written mission statement at the beginning of the book, I think, you know, it's really, it like comes down to that, like, you know, just like making the right thing, like totally amazingly fun.
Yeah. Your wife, Annalise.
Yes.
Wrote the little intro.
She did.
And in that, she says, you know, there were a couple people, Mateo Keller being one, that really kind of informed, when you're doing something of this ilk, you also have to do it for a reason, for a purpose,
right,
you know, and you can't just sit there and have fun. And I know you are enjoying yourself, but you're thinking that much deeper when, you know, you choose to open a business, when you choose to write a book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're choosing like what you do with your life, like what you, you know, it's like the, I don't know, the difference between like, you know, working for like a military industrial complex contractor and like making like five, you know, figures or something, you know, six figures, and then like, or like doing something that like makes the world a better place, you know, in every conceivable way. Like, you know, like good meat is better for the environment. Like, you know, it's healthier for like, you know, people. Like, you know, especially when you're doing it locally, it's like bringing money, keeping money in the local economy, not sending it off to some like, you know, nameless, faceless, you know, multinational corporation that like doesn't care about like their workers and, you know, like, yeah, it's just, you know, it's, you know, just doing like choosing what you're going to do with your life and really understanding that, like, you know, you're making a difference. It's not like a huge difference, but it's like, I feel like, you know,
it's a, you know, the easiest thing to look at in the book is that dollar bill, that percentage of, you know, how much is given back to the farmers.
Sure.
You know, versus a supermarket chain, and which I think it's 10% versus like 32%.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, the, yeah, I think we do it in like, in cents, cause it's like, mm-hmm. like more money revolve. But yeah, I mean, it really like comes down to the economics of it. It's like, we like the 32 cents that go back to our farmers versus the 11 cents that go to like when you buy something at the grocery store, you know, and then people are just like, well, this still doesn't seem like very much. And it's like, well, but all the other cents in that dollar go to like the local trucking company that's like, you know, mom and pop business. Like we pay the slaughterhouse, which is a family owned slaughterhouse who pays all their employees well. And like, you know, like it's all staying in the local economy, like paying people to do a real job that is really important to growing the infrastructure for local food, you know, local meat in the, you know, in and around the New York, you know, state area.
So I want to know, you know, what is a Wangus? I mean, there are all these different cows.
Wangus.
Yeah. But I mean, you've supported now Berkshire pigs coming in. You've supported all these local farmers in a way that not many other people in New York were initially.
Yeah, no, I mean, we like we got to work with a lot of different farmers. Like when we were doing our previous butcher shop, or working at a butcher shop previous to this, and we just chose the ones that we really not just like the quality of the product, but also, you know, like them as people, because, you know, we got to visit the farms and hang out with them, and we have a very close relationship with our farmers. And, you know, we do something that not a lot of other people do. They, you know, we have like a handshake contract. And it's just like, okay, we will take this much, you know, these many animals from you, like, you know, forever. You know, there's no, we're not like shopping around trying to like save 25 cents. We're like, okay, like, you know, you can plan the future of your farm around, like, you know, what you sell us, because we will always buy that. I mean, unless we go to business or something, I guess. But and we also support them doing, you know, really, you know, like trying things out. And, you know, we buy it. And even if it's not good, well, it's usually very good. But, we figure out something to do with it, you know. But, yeah, the Wangus thing. I wish we could get more of that. But, yeah, like this guy up in the Finger Lakes bought this like $10,000 Wagyu, you know, which is Kobe beef to most people, breed bull, and he only to figure out that it like didn't really like eating just grass because that's not how they're sort of raised. But you know, he got these like all these like half Angus, half Wagyu animals like later after he had like sold them, because you know it takes a long time to make a cow. Or the gestation period, I mean. And they were incredible. They were like nothing I had ever seen. They were like, I've never seen grass-fed meat that like literally looked like Wagyu, like Kobe beef. It was insane. But I mean, that's the kind of stuff we try to say yes to, you know, a lot of things that like people would say no to, I think. You know, we're like fiscally conservative, but we're not you know, we're very open to you know, we want to, you know, like keep those dollars and cents like, you know, in the bloodstream of New York State, but we're, you know, say yes to a lot of really like out there ideas that I think most people would be like, yeah, that's weird, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, say yes to the meat hook. Say yes to the meat hook. Meat book. Stop in. If Tom doesn't have time for you, just flip through the pages. It will piss him off a little bit.
I'll have time.
Yeah.
I'm just working. I mean, when I'm not on book tour, I'm just like at the shop all the time.
Excellent. And thank you guys for roping me into this project again. Again, best summer of my life. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Durkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.